And thank you for holding. At this time, your lines are in listen-only mode. A public comment period is scheduled to take place after the opening remarks. If you are interested in commenting on today's topic, you may press star 1 on your phone at any time to be placed into the queue. There is a limited time set aside for public comment, so please keep your comment to less than 1 minute. Stating your name and affiliation when prompted is optional. However, please provide at least an identifying alias. This will assist in administering the session. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would like to turn the call over to Odette Madriago. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. I'm Odette Madriago, Acting Chief Deputy Director for the Department of Toxic Substances Control. Good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are. I want to start by thanking all of you for taking the time to spend some hours with us this morning, as well as some time with us on the 19th to discuss the topic of how we consider products in the prioritization process. We are anticipating these discussions to be very valuable in terms of providing input to the May 5th and 6th full meeting of the GRASS here in Sacramento. Now, a little bit later in the agenda, I will briefly review the topic paper that was prepared for this phone call, which all of you should hopefully have. During today's call, I and other DTSC staff will be available to answer questions, and at times we may interject to ask for further clarification or to ask for more specifics on suggestions you may be making. And at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Kathy Barwick.
Good morning, everybody. I am Kathy Barwick, staff to the panel. I'm here on DTSC. I work for the program. And I'm going to do a brief roll call right now. I'm going to start by querying the panel members. And if you would please, panel members, let us know if there's any member of the public visiting there with you so that we can more efficiently manage the public comment periods. So if I'm going to call your name and just answer back. Debbie Rafael?
Present.
Bruce Cord? Jay Che?
Present.
Mike Kirshner?
Here.
Scott Matthews? Kelly Moran?
Present.
Dele Ungansitan? Roger McFadden?
Present.
Mike Wilson?
Present.
And Julie Shannon. So I didn't hear any anything about members of the public, so just let us know if you get a visitor. And we have a number of DTSC staff here in the room. We'll go around the table.
Leonard Robinson.
Colleen Heck.
Jeff Wong.
Corey Yep. Kelly Kirkpatrick.
Hortensia Muniz.
Evelia Rodriguez.
Thank you very much. And now I'm going to turn this over to your GRASS co-chair and subcommittee chair, Debbie Rafael.
Thank you, Kathy. Welcome, everyone. I would like to begin with a welcome to this subcommittee meeting of the Green Ribbon Science Panel, and thank you for joining us today. This is subcommittee number 2, covering product identification and prioritization. This is the first of 2 meetings on this subject. The second meeting will take place on April 19th. The purpose of this subcommittee is to provide an opportunity for a select group of panel members to engage in more detailed and interactive discussion with Department of Toxic Substances Control staff prior to our reporting on these discussions at our full panel meeting on May 5th and 6th in Sacramento. This should best be thought of as a working session. We will be taking notes, and those notes will serve as the basis for our report to the full panel meeting. It is important to note that we are seeking to offer our advice and comment to the department staff as individual panel members, and we are not trying here to reach agreement or consensus on that advice. The desire for this discussion is that we try to be as concrete as possible in our response to the questions and in our analysis and suggestions to DTSC. It is also important to recognize that this is a public meeting, and members of the public, as well as other panel members, may be listening in on our discussion. We will open time shortly for members of the public to share ideas with us. This is a reminder to all of the public who would like to share their public comment, to press star 1 so that you can enter the queue. You don't need to wait for the public comment period to start. We would like to invite you to press star 1 now so we might know how many of you there are. The department staff has put together a topic paper that includes 3 questions. This topic paper, plus a set of attachments, has been sent to you in advance. If you did not receive these documents, please let us know now. Is there any member of the panel who did not receive the documents? Great. Odette will provide a summary of the documents, which I hope you have had the opportunity to review. I know there was quite a lot of material included, but we felt that each piece offered pertinent examples and background for our discussion today. After Odette's introduction, we will open up the phone lines for public comment. After the public comment, we will begin our discussion with a brief opportunity for any clarification you may need from the department in order to thoughtfully address the questions. We will then take up each of the questions in sequence. I am hoping that we will cover all 3 questions today, such that we can consider our responses over the next week and dive even deeper on all 3 questions at our next meeting on April 19th. In summary, we are being asked to advise the department on how regulations can best be written to most effectively identify and prioritize products in the California economy. This product identification and prioritization provides a central focusing process within AB 1879. This is really the first time the panel members have explored this issue at length. It will be important for us to interpret the law correctly while finding the most effective basis for meeting its intent. DTSC staff are on the call to help us do just that. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Odette.
Thank you, Debbie. So I'm going to briefly go over the topic paper. I hope you have it in front of you. As you can see on the first page, there is a summary of the pertinent statutes. And should you have questions on them, we will be happy to answer them. So, and there's also a list of the attachments that have been provided as background material for you. So turning to the questions, there are 3 questions that we are asking this subcommittee to address. Question 2A is, how should products be identified and classified? Specifically, in considering exposure potential, should we look at products based upon the ingredients they contain? For example, ingredients that are showing up in biomonitoring and environmental studies, or ingredients that are banned from municipal solid waste disposal. Those are just some examples. There could be a number of others that could be used for this approach. Should we consider mode of application in considering exposure potential? For example, whether the product is applied directly to the body, is a spray or an aerosol, or is used on hard surfaces and could have the potential for runoff, and other types of modes of application. Thirdly, should we consider products used by or marketed to sensitive subpopulations, for example, children and women of childbearing age? A final example of exposure potential consideration would be high volume products, such as personal care products, household cleaners, and other types of products that are found in the marketplace in high volume and that are frequently used by consumers. Those are just some examples. There could be others that members of the subcommittee would like to explore. And then there's the consideration of functional use. You could perhaps choose to group products by the functional use. Examples that are given here are solvents and flame retardants. So that's the first question that we're asking the subcommittee to consider today. The second question, question 2B, asks, what criteria and process should be used to include and prioritize products on the list? To begin with, what exposure potential factors should be used to prioritize products? Examples would be the percent composition, total volume in production, frequency of use, how it's used, who uses it. Those are just some examples. Secondly, in assessing a product's threat of adverse impact associated with each identified exposure potential factor, there's 3 sets of sub-questions. Should there be a threshold established for each factor? If so, how should the threshold be determined? Secondly, should the prioritization evaluation be based on the product's individual threat of adverse impact or the product's contribution to cumulative or aggregate adverse impacts? If it's the latter, how should this be evaluated? And thirdly, should we use a ranking formula to apply the identified prioritization factors? And if we use a ranking type formula, should the different factors be assigned different weights? And you all may have other ideas for the criteria and the process that you suggest the department use for prioritizing products. The third question before the group today is question 2C, and this addresses the size and changes to the product list. What approach should we take here? For example, do we just list specific products the first time that the regulations are promulgated and then explain how additional ones would be added to the list and the process? Or do we just set up a process and not mention specific product categories in the regulations? Another possible approach, an example of which has been provided in the packet, it's an approach that's similar to an approach used by California Air Resources Board, would be that in the regulations we would list specific product categories and then group them in terms of the time frame in which they would be addressed. So you might have several categories for which alternative assessments would be, work plans would be required by X date. For the next set, it would be a later date down the road and so forth. And you may have other ideas. So that's a very brief summary of the issues before us today, and with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Debbie.
Okay, thank you, Odette. And Odette didn't, I just want to thank her so much for putting together these attachments. I know there was a lot in there, and I just want to call your attention to the fact that some of these questions, we have specified particular attachments that we felt were relevant because they showed either lists of chemicals that would be relevant, or they were methodologies that were already trying to tackle some of these questions. And so we were hoping they would sort of get people's juices flowing. And when we get into the discussion, I will refer to specific pages of those attachments. So I'm hoping that everyone on this call either has their computers up or their hard copies spread out on the table, because this is truly a working session, and we're going to be looking at these attachments for information and inspiration. So with that, we are now ready to open this up to public comment on the agenda item. And the operator, I believe, will – do you have an idea of how many people are in the queue?
At this time, we have one caller in the phone queue.
Okay, our lessons have from past calls have showed that there's a bit of a delay, so I'm going to just wait for about 15 seconds for anyone else who would like to press star 1 now to do so and join the queue. Is there anyone, and while we're waiting, is there anyone at the other satellite locations who has someone from the public who would like to speak?
No one at UC Berkeley today.
Thanks, Mike.
Uh-huh.
And once again, at this time, if you'd like to provide comments to the Green Ribbon Science Panel subcommittee members on today's topic, please press star 1 and ensure your line is not muted. You will be prompted to record your name. Stating your name and affiliation is optional. However, providing at least an identifying alias will assist us in managing the session. Again, pressing star 1 will enable you to join the queue and make a comment. If you wish to remove from the queue, press star 2. One moment while we wait for our first comment.
Okay, so because it appears we do not have a good deal of public comment, I don't know who this person is, the lucky one, but please feel free to take 3 minutes for your comment.
Dawn Kepke, you may ask your question.
Hi, good morning. This is Dawn Kepke on behalf of the Green Chemistry Alliance. Appreciate the opportunity to speak and also for the additional 2 minutes. The issues are complex, so it's tough to get through so quickly. I guess I'm just going to, you know, touch on a few things, and just, you know, one of the key points here is that the mandate of AB 1879 is to identify those chemicals in consumer products which may pose a threat to human health and the environment, and thus warrant additional regulation. And this is really critical because essentially the legislature concluded in this vein that a meaningful prioritization process was necessary to achieve the objective to address the worst first. And consistent with the statute, the Green Chemistry Alliance has affirmed that the prioritization evaluation process be based on exposure as well as hazard, and that it avoid duplication, conflicting regulatory requirements, which is consistent with the legislative intent and statutory directive. Upon identifying chemicals of concern, obviously the department can immediately begin evaluating consumer products containing these chemicals, taking into consideration data from various authoritative bodies and industry trade associations or consortia that are working with these products and developing them. And we think that industry involvement is going to be critical to the process and making it workable and helping to prioritize. We would want to emphasize the fundamental importance of the process to select the priority products to undergo the alternatives assessment, and that the prioritization process should focus on evaluations of reasonable and foreseeable consumer exposure, especially for products targeted towards sensitive subpopulations, rather than solely on the properties of the individual chemicals in the consumer product, since exposure and risk vary depending on the product and how and by whom that product is used. So we're really, really wanting to see that exposure be upfront and that it be reasonable and foreseeable exposure considerations. Additionally, on the duplication side of the issue, under the statute in SB 509, it clearly indicates that DTSC is not permitted to supersede the regulatory authority of any other department or agency, nor may it duplicate or adopt conflicting regulations for product categories already regulated or subject to pending regulation. It's the Green Chemistry Alliance's strong opinion that it is essential that any applicability of the regulation not conflict with, impede, or frustrate other regulatory schemes or systems by which products are currently reviewed. Furthermore, we've consistently advocated that the regulation should only apply to intentionally adding ingredients into consumer products that serve a functional purpose at or above 0.1%, and this is consistent with other state, federal, and international systems by which manufacturers are currently regulated. An example of one of the systems that we work with internationally is under the European Classification, Labeling, and Packaging Directive that applies to both chemicals and product mixtures and includes that default of 0.1% with case-by-case considerations of lower or higher thresholds based on other authorities and the need to alter them. And we're just really, really wanting just to be clear that we're concerned that if this program failed to be implemented on a science-based approach to screening out products with low likelihood of harm, we're just concerned that the program will surely collapse under its own weight, which would not be in the best interest of any of us, and really we want to see a program that's workable and focuses on the worst first, as we indicated. So, again, I appreciate the time and the extended comment opportunity, and thank you. Look forward to the discussion.
Thank you, Dawn. That was very helpful. So,
Our next public comment comes from Mr. Gregg. Your line is open.
Thank you. This is Bill Greggs on behalf of the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Today's discussion is about the prioritization of products that use previously determined chemicals of concern. Prioritization of products in this context means setting up an order for alternative assessment, a relative ranking that would do the worst first. I've studied the example systems and criteria that were shared in the pre-work, systems that add up or multiply up the criteria, criteria like detection and biomonitoring, indoor air, dust, and use in products. These criteria are great for getting started but don't go far enough. Every single idea is based on yes, no. Is it present? Is it not? This, in essence, is bean counting, but only counting the beans that have been detected so far. Every scientist on this call appreciates that we could find every chemical in every compartment if measured with perfect detection. Prioritization should be scientific work, not bean counting. It should employ relative ranking of high-end exposure from categories of products. It should use sentinel products in each category to help identify the priorities. Sentinel products can be selected to address sensitive subpopulations as mandated. Such a process is ongoing in the Canadian Chemical Management Program, where the highest priority 200 chemicals were identified and priority uses were assessed over the past 3 years. I urge the panel and DTSC to make this about science, not about bean counting. Look to Canada's scientific approach. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greggs.
Our next public comment comes from Alan. Your line is open. Alan, your line is open. Alan, your line is open for a public comment. He's withdrew from queue. At this time, we have no further questions.
Thank you so much, operator. Okay, so with that, then, we will move on to the discussion section of our call. And I just want to make a note that, just a time check, it's 10 of 10. We are going to take a bio break at 11 o'clock for about 5 minutes. So just to manage everyone's expectations on that. So let me just call your attention to a particular attachment just to get us started off for the day. So if everyone would just look, actually, okay, we're going to do this and because I started it, and then I'm going to open it up to clarifying questions. But if everybody could get attachment 2-9 out, which is the Washington State Chemical Prioritization. And I numbered the pages because I have hard copies, but I want you to look at which is the third to the last slide, which says high priority chemicals and has two circles with intersections on them. Okay. And I've got two people here in the room with me, so I can see if they're still searching. And the point I want to make with this is that this is, at one level, a very simple model that we could be thinking about today, and that is that our colleagues who dove in deeper did the circle on the left, which is the high-priority chemicals. We, to some of the Don Kepke's comments and other comments, look at some exposure potential and products that contain that manifest that exposure potential, and the intersection is where prioritization happens. So that's what's going on in Washington State. Canada is doing something similar. I just want to put it out there as sort of the visual frame for one option, and what we're going to do today is really look at that right-hand circle to try and decide how are we going to take that universe of chemicals of concern and essentially narrow it down, funnel it into relevant consumer products. That is what the intent and the language of AB 1879 directs us to do. Before we dive deep into that sort of visual image that I just that we just provided, I want to offer the panel a chance to ask some clarifying questions. If and when you have a chance to review these documents and look at the questions and think about the task before us, is there something that was confusing to you or some clarification that you would like to ask Odette and other DTSC staff that would enable you to best answer the question at hand? So this is really a time, because we didn't have very many opportunities like this in the past, to ask some questions of the staff at DTSC. And the way we'll do this is you'll just say your name, and then I will start my own little cue process if need be. We're a fairly small group, 6 or 7 of us, so I may not need to do that. But if you could state your name clearly, that would be helpful. I see Kelly as a clarifying question. Anyone else? And Michael Kirshner has one? Okay, we'll start with that. Kelly, please go ahead.
Dad, what I'm wondering is why the
approach was this linear approach where you pick the chemicals and then you pick the products. And why you didn't consider other approaches, or if you did consider other approaches, why you picked this one?
Well, I think it's not, frankly, quite as linear as it may appear. You know, the statute clearly focuses on chemicals, but that they want it to be chemicals that are in consumer products, and they want it to be chemicals for which there is the potential for consumers to be exposed to them with adverse impacts, putting it very, very simply. I think really when we do chemical prioritization, you know, one of the things that group is talking about, and I don't know if you've been listening in on their phone call, but, you know, one part of that discussion item is the degree to which we consider exposure in prioritizing chemicals. And if we are going to consider exposure potential in prioritizing chemicals during the chemical prioritization process itself, we are going to have to consider the types of products that the chemical is used in. Likewise, when we get to product prioritization, we, you know, that part of the question that's being asked is you just look at the exposure potential, or do you combine, or in identifying and prioritizing products, do you also consider the relative adverse impacts posed by the chemicals in the products? Now, the reason why at the end we need to focus on products is because that really is what the alternatives assessment is going to be about. It is indeed going to be about the chemical concern in the product, but really in terms of assessing alternatives, you need to consider the product. So I don't know if that answers your question, Kelly, but, you know, we are certainly open to, you know, consideration of other approaches, other ideas that you and others may want to toss out.
Thanks. Oh, Mike is now clear. Good.
Hey, Debbie, if we want to ask a question, do we push star one?
No, no.
Oh,
you just yell.
Okay. I'll chime in after Michael.
He withdrew. He's all clear, so you're good.
Oh, okay. So this is Mike Wilson at UC Berkeley, and you know, thank you very much for putting all of the information together. Odette and staff, it was really helpful, and I think it's actually really useful for the discussion. And I guess my question is, in sort of looking at these question 2A, 2B, and 2C, does DTSC have information that you think could begin to answer these questions if you wanted to? So if we were to suggest that products should be identified and classified on the basis of high volume, for example, or that they're marketed to sensitive populations, or that they contain specific ingredients that show up in biomonitoring studies and so forth. If we were to make that recommendation, do you have the information to put those recommendations into practice today?
I would say, Jeff, did you want to answer? I would say anecdotally we have some of it. We certainly have not gone out and initiated the process of gathering the amount of information that we would need to do it. Now, you know, this was something that we gave a great deal of thought to in the regulatory process, and there, as you may recall, there in the last couple of drafts of the regulation, there's discussion about how we would go about seeking that information. But do we have it in-house as of today? No. Jeff, do you want to add anything?
No, I think that's correct. We don't have that information as a part of a formal infrastructure in the department.
So that's a great question, Mike. Does that then sort of color the way you look at these potential choices?
Are you asking me, Debbie, or at the DTSC?
Asking you.
For me, absolutely. I mean, there are, I think, you know, that's a really important bifurcation for me in the kinds of recommendations that I think are important.
Okay. Does anyone else have any clarifying questions? Because I can feel us going nicely now into question 2A with that question. Okay, and I just want to remind myself, we have Jay and Mike and Kelly and Roger and Mike on the phone. We have not been joined by Scott or Dele. Is that correct, Scott Dele? If you're not there, don't say anything. Okay. All right. There we go. Okay, so what? So I think, Mike, that actually brings us very nicely into question 2A, which is, how should we be thinking about products and grouping them, and knowing that what we do know about what DTSC's capacity is to answer those questions. So let's take a look. We thought very long and hard about how we gave these examples and grouped them. We certainly could have missed things. So what we're looking for here in this part of the discussion is responses. Is there something here that jumps out as key to you? Is there something missing, or is there a whole other way of looking at the way we think about products and prioritize which products to look at, knowing that the end game is to get to a regulatory response and to get to alternatives assessments, and thirdly, and very importantly, to send signals to the marketplace. So knowing that those are sort of three intents behind this process, so let me do the cue. Kelly? Anyone else? All right, Kelly, why don't you start us off?
I'll join in after Kelly.
Okay, thanks, Mike.
You bet.
I was glad Odette said what she said about that the other group was seeing that products and chemicals were linked, because that's what I've been struggling with, is I see that products and chemical selection are kind of inextricably linked. And Mike's question also came right to another thing, which I'm realizing the department is really smart, and folks are approaching this as if the department has to do all the work to do the prioritization. And we simply don't have the budget to do that. And because we would need a whole staff of experts to go through and do a lot of these things. So I've been thinking a lot about what can we do with the expertise and resources that we have that would not cost so much towards getting us there. And when we're setting the initial set of priorities here, I think we need to be thinking about using the expertise of other scientists outside of the department to help set the priority. So that doesn't mean that the department would not have the ability to propose and put things on the table, but I really think that we need to be looking at the petition process and consultations with the fellow agencies at the state and actually federal level to identify what the potential priorities would be for product chemical combinations to regulate. And the reason I say that is that the real way, you know, I've done a lot of work on water pollution, and it always starts with the same set of things. We've got a pollutant that's a problem. So you could look at the 303D list, but that's not it's always a little out of date and so forth. So, for example, copper is a problem. Then there's an exercise done of what are the sources of copper into water. And that involves a conceptual model, understanding what the products are that are out there, going through a good bit of scientific work. I don't think at this stage we can expect the department to be doing that for every pollutant, to go through a pollutant source identification and exposure assessment exercise. We just don't have the money for that. So we're going to need to start with things that have somebody else has already done that exercise and supplies the information to the department and says, based on our pollutant source identification work and our exposure assessment, be it humans or the environment, here is a product or several products that are the major sources or provide important exposures. So for copper, we identified vehicle brake pads and copper-containing architectural materials as being very large sources. And brake pads are one that's particularly difficult to manage at the watershed level. So that came forward. There's a body of evidence to go with it, and I would envision the department would be able to pick that up through a petition process or through consultation with the water board. Another great example is there's a problem with polyaromatic hydrocarbons are important pollutants. There are several different important sources. One of those sources is a consumer product that's pavement sealants. These aren't widely used in California, but we don't really want to go there. And that's another one that's been identified by NOAA Fisheries, part of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. USGS has done the work again. There's pollutant source identification and other information to link it to the product. And so that kind of information can come in through petitions and consultations. And that way, there's a body of evidence that can be put into the queue for the department to say, okay, here are some products that we can start with. And I'd urge a lot of thought be given in this initial round to not putting the burden on DTSC to make those decisions, but rather be going out and soliciting the expertise of other scientists to bring into the equation what needs to be done. We should not preclude DTSC from putting things on the table, but that way we don't put all the burden on DTSC to do that, and we don't inadvertently cut off the use of these regulations to get some easier wins that are out there that are going to be really important for environmental and human health protection.
So, Kelly, I'm going to just go back. Because we have a small group and we have time for this, I want to go a little deeper on that.
Yeah.
So when I look at exposure potential, when I look at question 2A, what I'm hearing you say that indeed some of these should be explicit in our process, that our priority pollutants in water or are in biomonitoring studies, but then translating them to the products, choosing that is not something that we have to necessarily have in a list, but can have set up a process by which there's consultation with other agencies that they would then say, what are the products that meet those criteria?
Yeah, I'd actually go back, and I would really urge the department to think seriously about a very simple process for setting priorities. So not putting a lot in the regulations, because you're more likely to close doors that you wish you'd left open. And to instead say, let's take in all this different feedback and establish a product rulemaking calendar that looks out several years. And we take that feedback from petitions, from consultations with our fellow agencies, from the information that we have, and that we look specifically at product chemical combinations.
Okay, so what I'm hearing is the process should be, the process focus would be on consultation and petition, not so much on in the regulations setting out product categories.
Exactly. In fact, I think it would be very, at least my experience is that I would strongly advise against listing product categories in the regulation, and I also would strongly advise against creating an inflexible list of chemicals based on some arbitrary selection criteria, because then we would actually preclude ourselves from solving those key environmental problems that need to be solved and can be solved quickly.
Okay. Thank you.
Debbie, I really need to jump in here, all right?
Please.
Okay. I'm trying to understand what I just heard from Kelly, and I'm talking about from a legal perspective here, legal procedural perspective concerns. Well, I think there's nothing that compels us to list product categories in the regulations. I was getting a little concerned with the discussion about having not too much specificity in the regulations. There needs to be enough specificity in the process that's laid out and the criteria that's laid out in the regulations to meet certain Administrative Procedure Act standards in terms of clarity and specificity. Failure to do so, I think, could potentially push us into the realm of having to go through the full-blown regulatory process to actually adopt the lists themselves. So just want you to keep that in mind.
Okay. That's a great clarification. Thank you. That's a very important balancing act that we have here. Flexibility so that we don't preclude ourselves, but enough specificity so that it's clear and predictable and understandable to the outside regulated community. And, So, Mike Wilson.
Okay, thank you. I'm sort of picking up on some points here that Kelly made, and it sort of raises a initial question in my mind, and that is if the regulation is going to be focused on chemical products per se or all consumer products, and Kelly's example is a good one, and that is brake pads don't show up in the AR Resources Board's consumer product division for chemical products. This is a clarifying question first, and then I'd like to make some comments. But for Odette or DTSC staff, is there any further clarification about that, about the universe of the scope of the regulation?
I'm a little unclear about your question, Mike. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I guess it's thinking about chemical products specifically, from brake cleaners to personal care products to home insecticides and so forth, those that are actually sold as chemical products, general purpose cleaners, for example, versus what might be called articles. So brake pads, computers, desks, and so forth. Is the regulation going to be covering both of those, or chemical products only?
The regulation in terms of what it potentially could capture as consumer products will be very broad because the statute requires us to be very broad. And basically it would be stuff that is sold as a consumer product. And I know that's not being as clear as you would like. And if your question getting towards the status of bulk chemical products, is that where you're going?
No, it's more, I mean, I think that's a good question also, it's really more how we're
assembled.
Say again?
Are you talking about formulated versus assembled products?
That may be a way of describing it, for sure. I mean, the way I think of it is as chemical products, those that are actually formulated and sold as chemical products. And maybe what you describe as assembled products, like a desk.
I would say that both would be captured.
Okay. Okay, so that's...
Are you talking about, a shampoo versus a computer? Is that a good example of the question you're asking?
It's a very good example.
Okay, then yes, both would be captured.
Okay. Okay, so that's important, and I guess my thoughts are going to be focused on the formulated chemical product side. 164 million pounds of those sold every day in the state, at least according to the ARB data that are, 13 years old now. So I'm thinking now about formulated chemical products. I guess my, sort of picking up on what Debbie's charge here is based on the statute, advising the department to identify and prioritize those products in California. I want to just, refer back to the statute itself here, that it does stipulate three, areas that we have to focus on, one being volume in commerce, the second being those that have been identified by authoritative bodies, and a third, those that could be of concern to sensitive subpopulations. And I think, my first comment is about the question of volume in commerce. And this is just where we immediately run into this ongoing problem of our lack of information. And it sort of gets to Kelly's point about turning to some of our sister agencies and departments and so forth for their experiences in this arena, and specifically the Air Resources Board, the ARB's Consumer Product Division, and the challenges that they have had in gathering consumer product information that for purposes of identifying VOC content, and also more narrowly focused product initiatives around perchloroethylene and so et cetera, and some of the others. But it's been a very time-consuming and expensive process for the Air Resources Board to develop the data they need to set priorities. And some of that information, you know, when they've been able to finally gather the information they needed around VOC content, for example, turns out to be pretty surprising that formulated chemical products are, you know, again, 164 million pounds sold every day in the state, but about 90% of them were general-purpose cleaners. And that's, you know, an important piece of information when we're thinking about other questions about sensitive subpopulations, ingredients, and so forth. My point here is that we have to grapple with the question of a data requirement in some way here as part of this regulation. Because until we do that, we're not going to be able to, we just simply don't know what the volume, the high volume products are that are sold in the state of California. And I would propose that those, the information that DTSC needs to answer the question of volume in the state, are there are five key pieces. What actually
is the sale?
Mike,
can you get closer to the microphone, please?
Say again?
We're having a little trouble hearing you.
Oh, really?
Need to get close. It felt like you were leaning back for a minute, Mike.
Oh, is this better?
Yeah. So are you about to tell us the five things that we would need for to determine high-volume chemicals?
Yeah.
Okay.
The actually high-volume products.
Oh, high-volume products. High-volume products or high-volume chemicals that are in sold in products? I mean, to me, it's a little bit different.
Yeah, I'm looking at question 2A, number D,
okay,
which is high-volume products. And also that is what's described in the statute itself as So I'm looking at high-volume products. So that information is the sales volume of the product, its uses, that are its intended uses, its ingredients, the proportions of those ingredients, and the sales trends. And so with that information, we would begin to have a pretty good sense of what the high-volume products are in the on the market.
Okay. So, Mike, I'm just going to, like I did on Kelly, I'm going to push you a little deeper on this.
Yeah.
Given that we don't have that, maybe I'm making an assumption here. So, Odette, Jeff, do you feel like we have the capacity right now for DTSC to get those five levels of information? Do we have the authority to do that, or are we going to go into the same struggle that the Air Resources Board has?
Jeff, do you want to respond to that?
I don't know. I actually have to dig into the details of what ARB has in terms of quote-unquote struggle to get the information. I think we would need to go to, again, Research Division and get those details. I think we, too, would struggle to get that information. We have to gain institutional experience to understand where that information may be available or how we may be able to get it. We would have to have, again, resources to do a careful analysis of that data. And the third part is that we would have to have the resource to house and keep that information and keep it viable for continuous decision making.
Yeah, thank you. So with that, Mike, then I want to ask you, given that what we're trying to do here is give practical science-based advice and direction potential to DTSC, would you then suggest that looking at high-volume products is not a potentially useful tool because we wouldn't ever have the right information on that?
No, I mean, I think it's a useful tool, and I think it's important. And I guess there's two pieces of this. One is it may be that very practically speaking, that that information that has been gathered by the Air Resources Board for purposes of their VOC program might be of use to DTSC. And we should just simply explore that, you know. The second is that what I mean by ARB's struggle to get this information is probably better characterized as a threshold that they have to get over when they are trying to gather information, because there is no proactive requirement that you know, manufacturers provide that information to ARB. So they have to go out and solicit that information and conduct a survey and a sales survey and so forth, which is, you know, it's just an expensive and time-consuming process. So we don't have that information. It seems to me, and I don't know how we're going to get around this issue in implementing AB 1879, that we have to be candid about the fact that identifying and prioritizing chemicals in products is a really difficult thing to do if we don't have the basic information on what's actually sold in the state. And I would argue, and I think this is actually, you know, it's similar to what we heard from Don Koepke, actually, that that you know, we and also from, I think, from Bill Gregg, I think they both made good points that it doesn't make sense for us to base this entire process on hazard, that on hazardous properties or the simple presence of the chemical in a product, that it does make sense to understand what are the large volume products sold in the state, what do those products contain, and prioritize on that basis, which is essentially an exposure basis.
I hear the conundrum, and I, since I'm sitting in a room with other people, I can read body language. But before I call on Kelly to respond, I'm just curious if Jay or Roger wants to respond to this dilemma on volume of products or anything else that, you know, I want to bring us back to all of these exposure potential options, because I think we need to give some concrete recommendations on how we deal with them. But Jay or Roger, do you, either of you want to speak at this moment?
Yeah, this is Jay. To my mind, I would...
we can't hear you, Jay.
Oh, hold on.
Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, much better.
Okay, all right, good. Yeah, in my mind, I would rather see if, the high-volume product should be monitored because, number one, there is more chance for high-volume product to pollute, and then therefore, the impact on consumers is larger than the small low-volume product. So that's my opinion right now.
Great. So you're saying a monitoring of chemicals
that used in high volume
products. Used in high volume. Yes. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Roger, did you want to say anything now? You don't have to.
No, I would. I'd like to join in if I might.
Yeah.
I think there's a correlation here that DTSC may want to probe between the group that's looking at ingredients and the group that's looking at products for priority's sake. And what I mean by that is that if I go or you go to a local retail store to buy, let's say, items for remodeling your home, you can go in there and actually buy acetone in a container that says acetone. You can buy a container that says aqua ammonia. We'll probably say have somebody's brand on it, but it's a liquid ammonia. You can buy a household bleach, which is sodium hypochlorite. You can buy delimonene, which will be repackaged into containers and used for spotters. You can buy acetones for graffiti removing. You can buy muriatic acid for your swimming pool. And methyl ethyl ketone, you can buy that way. The reason I'm bringing that up is that there are certainly in commerce today products that are the pure chemical or a form of that pure chemical that are already being sold in your state under the chemical name itself or some synonym of that name. So one thing you might want to consider is to look at those types of products somewhere in your priority list because they're chemicals for priority sake, and they're also being sold as products for functional uses, which you will want to identify as well. I agree also on the idea of, not that we need to agree here, but I do think high-volume products should certainly be, if they can be identified, if there is a way that ETSD can identify high-volume products and the chemicals that are associated with those products, it sure makes sense to take a look under the hood at that as an option. Go ahead.
I just want to ask you about your explanation of those chemicals that were sort of, you know, you buy acetone or you buy methyl ketone or ethyl ketone. Are you suggesting we focus on those because those would have a higher concentration of the chemical of concern? Was, again, a volume sort of exposure model? Is that why you were thinking of those?
Well, I'm thinking in two forms. One, yes, they are. Most of the time, they're in a very large percentage. A large percentage of what's in the container is going to be that particular chemical that they're listing. In the case of chlorine bleach, for instance, household bleach, that wouldn't necessarily be the case. Maybe 5.25%. The reason I'm bringing it up is that if you're looking for a way to identify those that you go after and to look at first, it may be that some are already packaged in consumer products and identified that way.
Yeah, you're just saying it'd be easier to find them.
Yeah, it'd be easier to locate them because they already exist there by that name. I would also like to suggest under exposure potential, you're talking about show up in biomonitoring, priority pollutants, et cetera. Maybe think in terms of also looking at poison control centers. Poison control centers can provide and do provide a fair amount of insight into how these products are interfacing with the public today because they handle phone calls related to exposure to products and chemicals. And they may have some interesting data that they're able and allowed to share that may be useful. And maybe you do that already. If not, I would sure
recommend. That's a great suggestion.
Yeah, and then Consumer Product Safety Commission, if you go into that website and, you see a fair amount of products you might recognize out there that are either recalled, either voluntarily recalled or regulatory recalled, usually there's a descriptor on why they were recalled, and sometimes those are associated with exposures. Maybe it was containers that leaked, whatever it might be, but that might provide some insight as well for DTSC to look at some ways to identify those exposures.
Okay, thank you. So, Michael Kirshner.
Thanks, Debbie. I just want to kind of go back to the we're talking about formulated products here generally, and I just want to in a way reinforce that by saying that there's already a requirement for these formulated products that are sold to consumers to list their ingredients at the federal level, but there's not the same sort of requirement for articles for assembled products. So it's a lot more difficult to identify the location of these of any specific substance in articles. I'll use the term as defined by the European Commission. So I think we're going to have to go there eventually. I don't want to go there right now. I think we need to initially focus on formulated products and because it's just that much easier to know what where we need to target based on chemicals of if the chemical is identified first. That's another whole issue is, you know, chicken and egg, what do you identify first? But the ones who really have a clue on the volume of these things at some aggregated level is going to be industry, the ones who bring the stuff into this state and the ones that sell it. Their industry associations track this one way or another. So as Dawn said, I think there's an opportunity here for working with them. You get an initial list of chemicals and work with the associations that are related to those chemicals. Each chemical seems to have its own industry association almost. And through them, they can be a source for information about volumes that are, I'm not sure they define it by state typically, but if anyone's going to have the capability to produce that sort of information, they would. Now, I don't know about whether they would hand over that sort of information to the state or not, but and maybe that's an opportunity for another regulatory requirement, but that's, I think, you know, otherwise we're looking at things that are not necessarily precisely aligned with the requirements of this regulation. We're looking at the Air Resources Board, and they have, you know, orthogonal concerns to this. Well, not orthogonal entirely, but, you know, they're not going to match 100% with what AB 1879's requirements are. Mm-hmm. So,
this it might be a good juncture for me to jump in real quickly on this whole issue of our ability to get data from manufacturers or others. You know, it's clear, as we have said all along to folks, you know, we do have legal jurisdictional problems when it comes to requiring information from out-of-state manufacturers and potentially also some. There are some questions in terms of under what circumstances we can require from in-state manufacturers and retailers. That is why if you look at the last couple of drafts of the regulations, you'll see how we've gone about trying to address this. And it obviously is somewhat complex because of this legal jurisdictional issue. And I don't want to go take the time to go into the details there except to say that I think that we do have a way to motivate people to provide this information to us, and so I think we could get a lot of the information, and several of you have provided us with some good ideas that frankly I don't think we'd thought about before, but it isn't, you know, the process is not going to be a super easy, straightforward process. It is doable, so I just wanted to toss that out for you to think about.
Thank you, Odette. Kelly. Yeah, I want to take us back to the challenge of how do we, with very limited resources, establish a set of priorities and get going on the first round of regulations. And what I'm hearing in this discussion is a lot of discussion about the things that DTSC would initiate, it would have to develop its own information on, and so forth, and what are the practical realities of that, which are that the department has some tools to do some things and some very limited resources to generate its own information and set priorities. And I just keep coming back around to the idea that we're really going to need to think a lot about how we structure a process that's going to be able to take action where it's merited and to be able to keep those doors open but still to set priorities. And I think that we need to think about how does the department set priorities in terms of product chemical combinations, because it's whether it's an article or not an article, it's still it's a chemical in a product that is what's a problem. And it seems to me that there are, and I'm just going to list some factors. So if I was writing a regulation, I'd be looking for various means of setting priorities, and that would include, you know, petitions, consultations, and the department's own initiated work. I would take all of that information together, and then I would say, what can I feasibly tackle, and what bins do I want to put them in? And so there'd be a bin for we want to start working on regulations. There's a bin for we think that these are potentially really a problem, but we need a little bit more information. And then there's another bin for we're going to have to think about this later because we don't have enough resources to put it in the top couple of bins. So then what we need are priorities for how, for criteria for how we would bin all of the various things that are out there that are we think might be priorities. And one of those, of course, is that this product chemical combination is linked to some kind of harm. So there's a harm to humans, there's harm to the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and the level of harm, documentation of harm, you know, what decision you make, you know, what weight of evidence is necessary, those are things that they're going to form a lot of arguments. So I recognize that the regulations have to be very carefully written in this area, because we do want to prevent future harm as well as address currently ongoing harms. So another one is that is this the this particular product a major source of exposure, either human exposure or environmental exposure to the chemical that we're worried about? And so that could be holistically when you're looking at a watershed, it's, you know, brake pads and then the other copper sources, or it could be through particular incidents, like use of a particular consumer product causes a particularly significant exposure or could cause a particularly significant exposure. Then we need to also think about costs. So there's a certain set of costs, and particularly important are costs to government in setting priorities. Government is spending a lot of money, for example, managing waste or dealing with compliance, other kinds of things. So cost needs to be a factor in here, to the extent we can get a feel for that. And a good example of that is that the cost for compliance, if we hadn't phased out copper and brake pads, would have been over $100 billion statewide to local governments. That should be a consideration in setting these priorities. Then another one, and this is similar to what the ARB has a factor, is are there good alternatives available? So a higher priority for action would be something where information is made available to the state that shows that there are practical, cost-effective alternatives for business to be using, and that reduces the necessity of the particular pollutants. That going with that is where there aren't good alternatives or where the evidence shows that, like for the ARB's VOC regulations, they take the evidence and they say, well, we can reduce VOC levels in this category of products somewhat, but we know we can't get it down to 2%, we have to leave it at 10%, or we'd eliminate this whole class of products. So that kind of evidence would be evidence that the department would want to have available to it in setting its priorities and making a decision whether to pursue a particular category. So those are some suggestions for prioritization criteria. And the one other thing I want to say here is that I'd really encourage the department, we've been talking a lot about the ARB's example, and in the packet that we received, what we got was the outcome of that. Here are the regulations that are coming into place and the dates. What we really need is to look back at what they were doing a decade ago after their law passed. They were saying, oh, what's the universe of products that are there? How can we break those into categories? They were determining, here's a list where we need more information and doing a survey. They went through this rulemaking exercise, the regulatory calendar exercise. And I think that what we're talking about here is larger, but it's very analogous in terms of how priorities were set. It was a mixture of things we can do easily and things that would get big VOC reductions that they wound up putting in their calendar. So I'll stop there.
Okay. So, Kelly, just to reiterate, I heard you say that in terms of prioritizing, we would look at the level of harm that that product chemical combination was. Is it a major source of exposure? What are the costs to manage? or compliance, and are there good alternatives? So did I capture?
Yeah.
So when I look at question, and I'm just going to do a time check. It's 20 of 11. What I want to do is finish on 2A in the next 10 minutes or so, and then move to 2B before the break, get us started on 2B before the break, although we've really sort of gone into 2B a little bit, but there's some things we haven't covered on 2A that I would love to get your guys' input on. So I heard people talking about volume as an indicator of exposure. Another indicator of exposure is, of course, A, right? I mean, that we've already seen it in, it's in people, it's in surface water, it's in dust. You know, we don't necessarily know how much of the product was it came from, but it's already an indication of exposure or a problem. A ban from municipal solid waste disposal is because it was showing up somewhere in the ecosystem. So when we, so those are, in my mind, indicators already that exposure has happened and therefore are not necessarily linked to volume. And I'm just wondering, to get your opinion on that, does that soften the need to, and Mike Wilson in particular, if things are showing up there as exposure, does that soften the need to know volume in commerce or not?
Yeah. Can I weigh in here, Debbie, or do you?
Yeah, that's my question to you, right.
Okay. Yeah, I think there's a potential amalgam here that's sort of in the spirit of Odette's point about the constraints on their on DTSC's ability to actually put in place data requirements in trying to implement AB 1879, and that may be sort of what you're suggesting, part of what you're suggesting here, Debbie, and that is that sort of a three-step process where we identify what we consider to be the chemicals of concern, according to the state of California, and that's that could be those that are showing up in biomonitoring studies, and they could also be, you know, we're developing this public library of materials, or the PLUM database that has, you know, chemicals that are identified by authoritative bodies as problematic chemicals around the world. There's about 3,000 of them. Biomonitoring. Chemicals that are showing up in biomonitoring are part of that list. And, you know, I realize this is not the the full scope of where this ultimately needs to go, but it's a place to start that, so we identify chemicals of concern, and that includes biomonitoring chemicals. The second step, then, is that California requires that companies that are selling products that contain chemicals of concern need to report that fact to DTSC. And that reporting would have to include a certain, you know, some amounts of information on how much is actually sold in the state and what its uses are. And then the third step is sort of picking up on what Kelly is suggesting about, you know, from that list, those products that are highest volume with the highest proportions of chemicals of concern rise to the top of the priority list. They're sort of the intersection of your Venn diagram there, Debbie. And those that have safer alternatives readily available rise to the very highest priority. So that's what I would suggest is sort of the three-step process that includes your point about biomonitoring chemicals.
Okay, thank you. Does anyone else have a comment about that? Because it sounds like, from Mike's perspective, we still need the data call-in, Mike, under that model, and I don't know that we're going to get it. So we're going to need to – okay, so I just want to – I want to also talk about item number two in the closing minutes on this, and we'll come back to this. This functional use, this solvent, flame retardant, the reason this is in there in terms of products is just to the idea that when you do an alternatives assessment, you tend to do it not for a chemical, but for a chemical use. So what is the best surfactant? Do you have to use nonylphenol ethoxylase? You know, are there alternatives to that? What is the best solvent for a degreaser, for example? Do you need to use chlorinated solvent, for example? I'm just not picking on anyone. I'm just using examples. And so it could be that in Kelly's sort of four things to think about, one of the, her last ones was the availability of alternatives. And one of the ways that we would answer that question is by looking really at functional use. And therefore, you might want to group your products, and maybe this is actually getting back to something, Roger, you were saying about you go on the shelf and you're looking for a degreaser and you see actual chemicals or disinfectant, although that wouldn't be covered, and you actually see chemicals that you could use. But perhaps we might want to think about functional use as a prioritization because it would help us answer the question, are there safer alternatives? So I just want to throw that out there now for you fellow scientists to think about in terms of making this practical and getting to the end point, which is safer alternatives. So anybody want to talk about that?
I guess I would ask a question, and it does, it gets to Roger's point, is how do we determine that? How do we determine what the functional uses are in the state of California? Do we go out to retail shops and look at the shelves?
I think it would be more that we would select functional uses of classes of chemicals. So we would say a priority would be what is, you know, if we saw that NPEs were a problem, they rose to some level of harm, well, their use is surfactant. So maybe we don't want to say cleaning products, we want to say let's look at surfactants and just then find the products and say any product that uses a surfactant would have to go through this process. And do an alternative. I'm just putting it out. I mean, maybe it doesn't. Maybe you're right, Mike. You still have the, always will have the problem of what's in a product. But, okay, sorry, keep going then.
Debbie,
yeah.
This is Roger.
Yeah.
May I join in, or am I interrupting?
Yeah, go ahead. And then, Mike, we'll come back to you if you want to.
Sure, of course.
But I was thinking about the logic of how I personally go about making decisions like this. So I'd like to talk us through this real quickly. First step is, does the product that I'm looking at contain a hazardous substance? That would be the first question I would want answered. And then, of course, this list that you've proposed in A that's been listed here gives me some insights into where I might go to identify that. Secondly, how is that product that I'm looking at going to be used? That's the functional part of it. Number three, are any subpopulations likely to be exposed to this particular product? Is kind of the third thing I might think about. In other words, are my children likely to be exposed to this product if I buy it, or my elderly grandfather or my elderly father who's approaching, you know, the end of their life, are they going to be affected? Fourthly, is this a high-volume product? And it sounds like it's a real challenge to get our arms around that, so I may not be able to make that determination when I'm looking at the product, but I'd probably, you know, I'd be interested from a community standpoint on how much of this is being sold. And then the last thing I would ask myself always is, can I find a safer alternative? If all these other things kind of make me question whether I really want to go forward with this product or not, I, you know, I'm not necessarily suggesting you ban it or indict it or destroy it. I'm as a consumer, I might ask the question, can I find another product that will functionally do the same thing, that will be exposed to the same subpopulations, that will be a safer alternative? So that's kind of, I'm just tossing that out as kind of a logical thought process that could be used to get to your endpoint here.
Yeah, and in fact, I think you're getting us into 2B very nicely. So before we really respond to that, Roger, Mike Wilson, I'm afraid, did I cut you off? You want to say some more things?
Well, I think, you know, Roger just in a very articulate way described what I was trying to say earlier on with what I described as a three-step process. But, you know, Roger, I think you just, your description there exactly parallels what I think needs to happen here. And, it, you know, beginning with does it contain a hazardous substance, that requires that we identify what those are. It might include biomonitoring and so forth. How is the product used? That's going to be a fundamental question that I'm saying we need a data call in on that. Are subpopulations likely to be exposed? Great question. Is it a high-volume product? Also a data question. And there are there safer alternatives? I think that's a really just excellent description of sort of how we go about doing this.
Thank you. All right, Kelly.
I've been thinking about this, what you guys are talking about, and I'm realizing that I don't see that we want to write the regulations that way, but we want to tell DTSC to think about these things when it's trying to figure out what products, particularly products that are of concern for human health exposure. And so I'm really distinguishing the scientific work that might be the basis of DTSC proposing something on its rulemaking calendar and actually how the regulations are written to say here are the things that are priorities. Because what you all are talking about starts with the product and then you're saying let's look at all these characteristics of the product. And what we're really thinking about is in all the universe of products that are out there, what products can we regulate to solve environmental problems or prevent environmental problems that have to do with environment or human health exposure? So it's kind of flipping the question around. We're looking at what's out there in the environment and what exposures are occurring and then saying how are we going to prioritize coming up with a set of regulations to do that. And all these things sound to me like things that would just interfere with our ability to come up with a targeted solution to a particular problem. So I'm kind of taking all that stuff and saying that's exactly what I want the department to do and our other state agencies to be doing when they're coming up with things that we should be considering for the rulemaking calendar. But when we're considering the rulemaking calendar, we need to really think about those more basic criteria so that we're able to solve big problems and small problems too.
And your basic criteria are level of harm, major source of exposure?
Level of harm, I don't call it major source of exposure, and that's actually really important. Biggest sources of that particular pollutant.
Biggest sources.
Yeah, so that's, it's not.
That's not a relative.
Yeah, it's
biggest.
Yeah, it is and it isn't. So
yeah.
it could be a one-time exposure or it could be an ongoing environmental exposure. It could be different things. So the cost and the availability of good alternatives. And let me just give you one more example so you can understand why I'm thinking this way. There have been a number of...
Before you wrap up, could you clarify a little bit more about why you would not want this laid out in the regulation?
Yeah, let me give you the example, and then I think maybe that'll help. There's another thing that's been actually in the legislature a whole bunch of times. People see it as a small problem, but it's got a really easy solution, which is that there are certain chemicals that people pour into their septic systems and their chemical toilets and so forth that are pollutants. And these are sources of groundwater pollution. They're problems for discharge to sewage treatment plants. And the legislature hasn't wanted to deal with it because they feel like they aren't expert enough. So these products are ones where we could take them off the market and use readily available alternatives tomorrow. They aren't huge volumes. They aren't big exposures to any individual person. But they're a particular problem in a particular location. So the department should have the ability to tackle and address this problem, which it can do very quickly. So what I'm distinguishing is research that's done behind the scenes to create the here are the potential candidates and work that's done through the regulatory process to say these are the things that are our top priority for our rulemaking calendar, as opposed to any other thing that's out there that we might want to look at.
Now, Kelly,
Debbie, can I ask
a rulemaking calendar?
Wait. Okay.
When we in the department hear that, we interpret that you are suggesting that we go through a full regulatory adoption every time we add things to the list. Is that really what you're suggesting?
What I'm suggesting is that you would come up with a
that just like the ARB, when it was back working on the VOCs, it came up with a plan that said, here's what we're going to do for the next several years. We're going to start working on, they're actually writing regulations for these four classes of products in 2011, and these four in 2012, and these four in 2013. We're going to start surveys on this group in 2011 and another survey on this group in 2012, and they laid that all out there and they took public comment on it. And
okay.
That's, so I am thinking that when you're making a rulemaking calendar, whatever you would call that, that you'd be thinking through those things, and your priority setting would be based on the criteria that are more broadly written in the regulation. But that wouldn't preclude doing all the other homework that we're talking about here.
So it sounds, just to be clear, Odette and Kelly, that I understand, it sounds to me like, Odette, you were thinking that if the process was specific enough in this regulatory framework, that you might not need to do a regulatory process when you added the next products to the list. Is that correct?
That has been our thinking all along, yes.
You see, so that's a little bit of a different take than what Kelly is suggesting. And it's just, we don't need to solve it today. I think it's important to have that distinction on the table and the consequences of that. Somebody else wanted to say something, right?
Yeah, I had a question for Kelly and a question for Roger.
Okay, and then after that, we're going to take a five-minute break, and we're going to then come back to 2B. Okay.
Okay. So the question for Kelly is, it sounds like you may be proposing sort of a two-track process, one that that sort of takes action on those problems that we have information on right now, like your septic tank chemicals example. And the second track is really gathering the information to have a broader regulatory strategy for the whole formulated chemical product universe. Is that, and then I have a question for Roger, but that was a clarifying question to you, Kelly.
Yeah, so you got the first part right. What I'm suggesting is that the department have a process to tackle known problems now,
right,
and a process, a second bin. So that part you've got. The second bin, I would say that the department's probably asking targeted questions towards determining whether it can come up with a right grouping and product approach to put it in the next round into the, this is a group of products that we're going to deal with. So
I don't understand.
You or other members of the group to comment on how we would go about specifying what is in that first bin of things that are, quote, known to be problems, because as you can imagine, there's probably going to be some debate over that.
Yeah. So what I suggested were those four was that the department would collect petitions, consult with other agencies, and potentially self-initiate based on the available resources and information it has, a group of product chemical combinations, and then it would use those criteria I suggested, the linkage to harm, the biggest sources of either, you know, biggest sources, basically, for either human or environmental exposure, the costs, and the good alternatives as the way it would set those priorities.
And we're going to get into when we get to 2B, as to whether or not we want to actually call out specifics or just have a process. Did you have a question for Roger? I want to take the 5 minutes. So did you ask your question to Roger?
Just the question was, in your process, your five-step process, how would DTSC understand how products are used? It was sort of your second step, and then your fourth step was would they determine whether it's a high volume product?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. Because I don't know what DTSC has in the way of resources to identify those two. The number two, how is it used, seems to be would be, in my estimation, the easier one, because there's a label associated with a product that should identify functional use. The fourth one on high volume, I'm not necessarily advocating that only high volume products would elevate to priority. I'm just saying that as I would think through this, it very well could be that in number three, when I found out that subpopulations were likely to be exposed to this hazard, I may not at all think that high volume is all that important.
Right.
I might at that point go back to my hazard rating and say, wow, this seems, you know, if my child, my two-year-old child could be exposed to this product, I want to take some action. I want to make sure I understand that. So I'm not suggesting that you have to pick high volume necessarily. I'm just saying that as you kind of go through the logic, I think you would want to go there. But it sounds like DTSC doesn't really have a very good handle on the volume of these things, of products. It may on chemicals, but it doesn't sound like it does on products.
I think that's right, yeah.
So,
yeah.
All right, so we're going to take a five-minute break, and when we come back, we're going to be ready to look at 2B, which is really asking some of the questions you guys have been sort of discussing a little bit about what are those factors, and let's see if we can, you know, get some concrete suggestions of what those factors. You have been very concrete, and I appreciate that, with your list of factors. But then we need to talk about, all right, if we're going to use those factors, do we rank them? How do we deal with multiple factors such as volume? I mean, you brought it up, Roger, yourself. If it's a high hazard, then do we not care about volume? And how do we determine that kind of relative ranking and thinking about what people have done in the past? So with that, it's about this. Our clock says 2 minutes after 11, so we will break for 5 minutes.